Hello, this is Julie Candler with the BBC News. Investigators in the United States have recovered the data recorder from the ship that crashed into the Baltimore Bridge on Tuesday, leading to its collapse. They're hoping it will shed light on why the container vessel lost power soon after leaving Baltimore port. The head of the National Transportation Safety Board, Jennifer Homendy, said they would look into whether dirty fuel could have played a role in the crash.
We've heard the reports. That's way too early for us. We have a lot of information that we are gathering, collecting, that we'll have to go through. We'll certainly look at that as part of our investigation.
A United Nations investigation has determined that Myanmar's military orchestrated a campaign of hate speech against the ethnic Rohingya minority ahead of its onslaught against them in 2017. Investigators said there was clear evidence the military was behind dozens of seemingly unrelated Facebook posts, which continued as Rohingya villages were burned and many of their inhabitants tortured or killed. Prosecutors in Spain say they want the former head of the country's football federation jailed for 2.5 years for kissing a player on the mouth following the National Women's Team World Cup victory. Luis Rubiales is facing charges of sexual assault and coercion. He denies wrongdoing. Here's Danny Eberhard.
It was a scandal that overshadowed a sporting triumph. As Spain's women's squad received their medals following their victory over England in August, Luis Rubiales clasped Jenny Hermoso's head between his hands and planted a kiss on her lips. She said it wasn't consensual. He disagreed. It prompted calls for him to resign. Mr. Rubiales resisted, defiant, before eventually being forced out. Prosecutors want him jailed, demanding he also pay Ms. Hermoso compensation.
Officials in Ukraine's second city, Kharkiv, say Russian-guided bombs have hit a school and a residential area, killing one person and injuring at least 16. Police say it's the first time Russia has used aerial bombs against Kharkiv since 2022. Volodymyr Timoshko is the head of the regional police force.
It seems the attack was carried out using a new type of weapon, a UMPD-30. This is something between a guided aerial bomb, which they have used recently, and a missile. It's a flying bomb, so to say. It's intended to hit people with the explosive wave. This is the first time this kind of weapon has been used on Kharkiv.
Reacting to the attack, President Zelensky urged the West to speed up deliveries of fighter planes and air defense systems. He said there were no rational explanations for why Patriot air defense missiles, which are plentiful around the world, were still not covering the skies of Kharkiv and other cities. World News from the BBC. A UN report has found that we are wasting almost one-fifth of the food we produce at a time when almost 800 million people around the world are facing chronic hunger. Researchers said the equivalent of at least 1 billion meals were thrown away every day, with knock-on costs to the climate. Food production generates up to 10% of greenhouse gas emissions. There's been outrage in France after the head teacher of a secondary school in Paris resigned after receiving death threats. The man had asked three pupils to remove their Islamic headscarves, but had an altercation with one who refused. France bans conspicuous religious symbols in state schools. Here's Hugh Schofield.
The head teacher, whose name is not being released, wrote an email to fellow staff saying he was resigning because of fears for his own safety and that of the school. Such threats are taken extremely seriously in France following the murders of two teachers by radicalized Islamists in recent years. Politicians of all stripes have reacted with indignation that a senior figure in education should have been forced to give up his position because of an online campaign. The hard right leader, Marine Le Pen, said it showed the government was incapable of protecting schools.
One of the main opposition leaders in the Central African Republic has been given a one-year suspended prison sentence for defamation and contempt of court. Crispin Mboli Gumba was arrested earlier this month after accusing magistrates of corruption. Human Rights Watch has accused President Faustin Archange Touadéra's regime of repressing civil society, media and opposition parties. Police in Togo have broken up an opposition news conference called to address constitutional reform. On Monday, Parliament voted for the new constitution, which changes the presidential system to a parliamentary one. But with less than a month before legislative elections, the opposition fears the change will clear the way for the long-serving president, Faure Gnassingbé, to remain in power indefinitely. BBC News.
The 2024 Wisconsin Film Festival is coming to Madison Thursday, April 4th through Thursday, April 11th. This year's festival boasts over 140 films of all shapes and sizes, including the best cinema has to offer from all over the world and right here in Wisconsin. We've got experimental, animated, and student films, as well as documentaries, restored classics, films for kids, and more. For the first time in years, we'll be returning to both the Bartell Theater and the Barrymore Theater. Plus, we've expanded on the UW campus into Music Hall, and we are heading east to Flick's Brewhouse at the Easttown Mall. The Wisconsin Film Festival curates, promotes, and exhibits programs that showcase the art of cinema. A complete festival guide is available in the March issue of Isthmus and online, and tickets are available at wifilmfest.org. The 2024 Wisconsin Film Festival is coming to a screen near you, Thursday, April 4th through Thursday, April 11th. Helping keep local arts alive for almost 50 years, this is WORT Madison.
Six above sea level. I grab my mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth has never heard before.
Hello, hello, listeners. I am Jessa Nicholson Getz, and I'm filling in here at Warts of Public Affair. Today, we're going to talk about the Constitution, specifically the Wisconsin Constitution. And with me to do that is journalist Jack Kelly. He's with the Wisconsin Watch, and he's been doing some in-depth coverage on a variety of proposed changes to our state's highest document. Welcome, Jack. Why don't you introduce yourself?
Thanks so much for having me. Yeah, I'm happy to be here. As you said, I cover the State House for Wisconsin Watch. So keeping track of all things the legislature, Governor Tony Evers, and the Wisconsin Supreme Court.
Excellent. So let's get it right into it. First of all, obviously state constitutions, federal constitution, different processes. And the federal constitution, quite difficult to amend. We haven't seen a constitutional amendment in decades and decades. The last one that I think, you know, they've tried several and nothing really changes. Whereas state to state recently, we've been seeing a lot of campaigns to amend state constitutions and alter things. Can you talk to us a little bit about why that might be?
Yeah, I think it's interesting, and I think the dynamics are probably state dependent. When we were prepping for the show, you had actually mentioned maybe we should talk about the difference between the federal process and the state process. And I had to look it up because the federal process is so complicated.
Insane.
Here in Wisconsin, the process is also a little bit cumbersome. So in Wisconsin, to amend the Constitution, the legislature has to pass an amendment in consecutive legislative sessions. And so that they have to do it in two separate two-year legislative sessions. And then it goes on to the ballot as a referendum, which is something that voters here in Wisconsin are very familiar with when you think about things like school funding. Often don't think about when it comes to statewide policymaking, especially because way back in the day, Wisconsin voters actually voted down a constitutional amendment that would have let them bring direct ballot initiatives like we've seen in other states, Ohio, Michigan, et cetera. And so here in Wisconsin, Republican lawmakers, who, of course, have been at odds with Democratic Governor Tony Evers over the last 5 years, have turned to the constitutional amendment process to really kind of codify some of their policy wins. And in other instances, just to advance their agenda, which they've been unsuccessful doing legislatively since they've been kind of in this deadlock with Evers over the last 5 years.
And I want to talk about some of what they're trying to do now, but you mentioned something, and I just want to back up for listeners that maybe don't know. Can you briefly explain the difference between a referendum and a ballot initiative?
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, they're like effectively the different terms for the same idea. But say in a state like Ohio, where it got a lot of attention over the summer, a group of voters there, it was kind of complicated, but a group of voters there moved to put a question on the ballot that basically said, should access to abortion be codified here? Should abortion be legal in Ohio? And it passed with overwhelming support, whereas you know, a referendum is usually, at least in Wisconsin, a little bit more targeted. Like on the April ballot, many folks that live, well, live in Milwaukee, that live in the Milwaukee Public School, you know, in the area that the district covers, will be voting on a referendum to increase property taxes, effectively to give MPS more money. So they're basically, you know, different terms for the same thing, but different states use them differently.
Absolutely. So you mentioned that there are efforts to sort of change the law to facilitate agendas that have been unsuccessful in more, and I guess I'm not sure if more traditional legislative routes is the right way to say that, because of course having the opportunity to amend a constitution is a bedrock principle of government, but something that we didn't historically see to the degree that we are currently seeing. I guess this is a new trend, at least in my lifetime, by way of techniques to facilitate agendas.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I think that that's interesting. I think it's really noteworthy now. So just from a little bit of historical context for Wisconsin, going into next week, Wisconsinites have been asked to weigh in on amendments to the Constitution 200 times. 148 of those 200 have been ratified. So they are overwhelmingly ratified, typically speaking. There was a spike in them in the early decades of Wisconsin as the state became a state and they needed to figure things out. And then they had definitely waned a bit. Since the year 2000, I believe there's been 10 of them. 9 of the 10 have passed. The one that was not was abolishing the state treasurer's office. And it's really interesting. But it's really interesting now when you look at what's contained in the amendments, right? Like some of the previous amendments that we've seen were, you know, changing things about the way that fees were collected, codifying the right to hunt and fish, you know, things that were very, you think of very quintessential either government functions or very classically Wisconsin things. The amendments that we see now very much so contain policy arguments or have rooted in policy arguments and policy disputes between the Republican-controlled legislature and Governor Evers.
So let's pick one. Why don't you give us an example of, because there are several of these that are kind of in the works right now, but let's sort of start with one and work through.
Yeah. Let's start with question one. That's going to be on next week's ballot on Tuesday. Effectively, they're asking, voters are being asked to weigh in on whether the Wisconsin Constitution should ban local governments from being able to accept grants, private grants, to help them cover the cost of election administration. We saw this in 2020. The pandemic made administering elections very expensive. It was difficult to recruit poll workers. They needed PPE. You know, there were a wave of mail voting, which is, you know, time consuming to process and expensive. And so local governments turned to private organizations. One major private organization is this nonprofit called the Center for Tech and Civic Life, which has received hundreds of millions of dollars from tech billionaire Mark Zuckerberg and his wife. And they took these grants to help them pay for the things they needed to run elections. Republicans have cried foul of this, saying that the grants, you know, boosted turnout in Democratic strongholds in the state. It was a primary focus of former Supreme Court Justice Michael Gableman's partisan review of the 2020 election. It has been a big focus. Here's where the rubber meets the road. Lawmakers passed a bill to ban municipalities from accepting private grants to pay for election administration. They send that bill to Governor Tony Evers, who promptly vetoes it, saying that, you know, it basically would leave municipalities with one route to get extra funding, which would be the state or the federal government providing it to them. And if they don't do that, they might not be able to effectively administer an election. So done, the bill's dead. Well, they bring it back as a constitutional amendment. And the real key to all of this is that constitutional amendments are not subject to a veto from the governor. So right. One of the questions on next week's ballot is next week's ballot is rooted in a policy dispute between Republican lawmakers and the Democratic governor, and they have pursued this avenue that basically cuts the governor out of the process.
And so what are the, I mean, I have opinions, but I'm going to ask you, what are sort of the consequences of that sort of technique that, you know, you've got veto power, we have checks and balances in the government, and then the response is to make what is a much more permanent change, or to attempt to make a much more permanent change. That feels different than just the change of course when a party takes over, or you have a, you know, when there's a Republican in office that vetoes versus a Democrat, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas the amendments, they stay long after whoever's in office leaves.
No, that is exactly right. The permanent nature of an amendment, or the, I should say, more permanent nature. As you had mentioned, nothing is ever permanent. you're right, though. I mean, if you want to roll back one of these changes, you have to go through the whole process again. You have to go through two-year legislative sessions. Then you have to put it to voters again. And so it is much more time-consuming, whereas if, you know, you pass a law and then come next session, there are different majorities, they can repeal that law. It makes the process kind of have, you know, extra layers of insulation from just, you know, either enacting or rolling back certain policies.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but it's also much easier to change the language of any particular statute than it is to change the constitutional language once it's been.
That's right. And if you want to change the Constitution, you have to go through that very cumbersome process. Or, I mean, you know, some, I guess, like extraordinary situations with lawsuits, et cetera. But yes, by and large, if you want to change the Constitution, you have to go through that very cumbersome and time intensive process.
And folks, you're listening to A Public Affair on WART 89.9. You can tweet at us at WART Talk. You can visit the Facebook page of Public Affair. You can email us at talk@wortfm.org, or today you can call in at 608-256-5627 to discuss any and all of this. All right, so the question one is, as you discussed, should we be able to skip, basically veto a veto, right? Is that, I mean, more or less what this is doing. What else is going on?
Yeah, so the other amendment that is on the ballot next week, so that first amendment banning, outside grants from, or banning local governments from taking outside grants to pay for election administration. That's question one. Question two that voters will see is this more broadly construed, kind of broadly written proposal, effectively that is aimed at preventing anybody that's not an election official from performing, and this is what the question is, quote, any task in the conduct of any primary, election, or referendum. Effectively, this is trying to keep non-election officials from being involved in administering an election. This stems from 2020, once again, in the city of Green Bay, where the city took a grant from CTCL. As a part of that grant, it got access to a series of consultants. It relied rather heavily on one of them to help do some logistical and operations planning. You've probably heard this name before. It was a guy named Michael Spitzer Rubenstein, and he has drawn the ire of Republican lawmakers, conservative activists, etc.
Just to talk about that, what is, just on a practical level, what's the problem with anyone getting help to make elections run fairly and efficiently?
Republican lawmakers talk about this. They basically raise these concerns that oftentimes the folks that are affiliated with these kinds of groups are, you know, more liberal leaning, or in the past have had some direct affiliation with Democrats, and that relying on outside funding and outside consultants is basically a way for, you know, nonpartisan officials or local government officials to, you know, boost turnout for their preferred party without really having to step into the partisan arena. And, you know, there was an extensive report done by the Green Bay City Attorney investigating, or I guess reviewing is a better word, maybe, Spitzer Rubenstein's involvement in the election. And it was largely, you know, they determined that it was
purely, you know, in an advisory role. He didn't have any decision-making authority. But still, Republicans have maintained that he's had this kind of like troubling involvement in an outside actor, an outside third-party person being involved in administering an election. So this question really does seem to be rooted in this one example. I certainly, you know, as a person who covers this very closely, cannot think of another example that jumps out at me here in Wisconsin that kind of fits the bill on this.
It's interesting to me, given, you know, the federal Supreme Court's holding in Citizens v. United and where we're willing to have outside influences and outside financing in our politics and where we apparently aren't. Just that's my observation. And so we've had some of these go into effect in the recent past. We've had two constitutional amendments this decade, at least two that I'm familiar with. There may have been more, but those are the two that I've got. And I guess, you know, me working in the criminal justice field, one thing we saw with Marcy's Law is there was obviously, and that's the amendment to the Wisconsin Constitution to sort of breathe some additional life and protection into what had been Wisconsin statutes, Chapter 950, which was our victims' rights statutes. Marcy's Law is a set of constitutional protections that has sort of swept the nation. There are a number of Marcy's Law states now. And it, among other things, gives victims the right to be notified about various aspects of court proceedings. It gives them some standing to object to certain things, to be heard on issues of bail, to be treated with privacy, dignity, respect, to refuse to cooperate with certain discovery requests. A number of these rights were already codified in Chapter 950. Some of them are new and they're certainly more expansive. And one thing that's been really interesting as sort of a boots on the ground person is they passed this sweeping constitutional mandate that requires district attorney's offices all over the state to suddenly do more things for victims, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That there are all of these requirements for victim contact that didn't exist before, but nothing about the process of amending the Constitution provided additional funding or additional positions or support for the people that are being asked to implement the practical effects of these amendments. And particularly in smaller counties where there isn't a dedicated victim witness staff. And I mean, even here in Dane, I can tell you, we originally had victim witness people that were like going out into the field and providing crisis assistance for victims. And after Marcy's Law passed, a lot of them ended up changed to a telephone, just calling and notifying of court appearances. And so it changed the dynamic, even in a well-funded victim-centered place like the Dane County District Attorney's Office. It changed the jobs people had been doing for a number of years without their input in many ways. And I'm curious, some of the more politicized stuff that we're talking about, can you speak to the potential ripple effects like that with these two that are coming up?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, Marcy's Law, of course, was a fascinating, just the process of Marcy's Law being enacted was fascinating. Of course, there was a legal challenge that the question on the ballot give voters enough information about these broad changes that would occur. Went all the way to the state Supreme Court. They ultimately said it was fine. But yeah, no, this is interesting. And to that point, the questions are often confusing. You're trying to take these broad concepts. I'm thinking about the bail amendments, which were on last April's ballot, that you are obviously very familiar with. And Jess and I had talked about this for a story that I wrote when I was still at the Cap Times as a brief aside, but the bail amendments were making significant changes to the state's bail system, and the questions were difficult to understand. These questions maybe seem a little bit more straightforward, but there are concerns about this. My colleague Alexander Schur and I, he was previously at the State Journal and just recently made a transition to VoteBeat, which is a great nonprofit news organization that covers voting and elections. We'll have a story coming out on this in the next few days. There are concerns among election officials, particularly about the second question, right? Preventing anybody who's not an election official from performing, quote, any task in the conduct of any primary election or referendum. What does that mean?
Right off the top of my head, I'm like, what about poll workers? Like people that volunteer, you know, I mean, because as broadly as that is drafted, that could eliminate all volunteer positions.
Right. In theory. And clerks have raised concerns of, you know, what is the conduct of an election, right? Does that mean that they can't have IT come and fix a voting machine? Does that mean they can't have, you know, the public works department help them set up polling places? There are questions. And the very likely outcome is that if this is ratified on Tuesday next week, which historically speaking, it, just by the pure numbers, seems like it could be, it almost certainly will result in a lawsuit seeking to clarify what it actually means. So then you've had voters ratify the Constitution just to turn back to the courts to say, what does the amendment to the Constitution mean? So it can create a really interesting dynamic. And I mean, it could really turn things on its head as Wisconsin, you know, approaches what is expected to be another very tight, very contentious presidential election.
Now, and here's another, of course, I'm going to focus on the legal aspects of this. Something that, again, is, I would suggest, different in terms of the ability to challenge things, right? Is a new law is passed and there are ways to seek sort of injunctive relief pending clarification from higher courts to figure out, like, are we applying this properly? Is this right? That's a little different procedurally when you've got a constitutional mandate. I mean, no one's going to enjoin the state of Wisconsin from enforcing their own constitution. That's not going to happen. I don't even think there's a mechanism for it, but even assuming there were, no sane judge is signing that, right?
I guess maybe there could be a challenge saying, you know, kind of like the Marcy's Law challenge, where they're saying that the question was too vague and it didn't provide voters adequate information about what the changes would be. I guess also maybe, I'm not an attorney, I will defer to you. I forget what the term is in it, itself, but there, you know, I think there is an extraordinary filing where you could make the claim that the vagueness of the question would just, it would, I forget what the technical term is, but it's basically, it'd be, this is too vague. It can't be right. Applied because it's too vague. And so I guess maybe they could try to pursue that route as well. Now, you know, putting the cart before the horse, you have to wait to see if it gets ratified. But yeah, there are certainly fewer mechanisms. You know, there's no, they can't pass a law and then immediately have somebody file a lawsuit saying this violates right. The Constitution. It would be the Constitution.
And so it's sort of, again, it creates this permanency that I think a lot of other laws just don't. And I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but that has the potential to one day not benefit the party that's seeking to influence it currently, right? I mean, the questions we've just talked about, given the climate right now and the concerns about voter turnout and, you know, because to me, I mean, it's a voter suppression effort. Those are my politics. That's my opinion. People can disagree with that. But to me, of course, you want everyone possible to show up and vote in your elections. That's how you have a functioning democracy. I don't understand this game. I don't understand why we're afraid of voters. I don't. If you can't get people to vote for you, develop better policies. This isn't that hard. Like, just do better and people vote for you. But setting that aside, it isn't as though with some of this stuff that it will always function in the way that the advancing party is intending at the time, right?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think that maybe a good parallel example to this was the legal fight, which has been renewed as of a couple of weeks ago, about the use of unstaffed absentee ballot drop boxes. If folks live in Madison, like you and I do, you see that in front of fire stations, there's these big blue boxes. Some of them have been changed as part of an art installation. They became very popular in 2020. COVID raging. What's the safer way to return your ballot in terms of, you know, pandemic in mind, than to go to an outdoor space and put it in a box that the clerk staff will then come pick it up? You know, an interesting thing about that is that clerks across Wisconsin use drop boxes. And arguably, they might have been more useful to voters who live in rural areas where they have part-time clerks who don't have regular office hours. And rely on something like an absentee ballot drop box so that, you know, every couple days they can go to this secure locked box and collect the ballots from their residents. So, you know, it would be interesting to see how it plays out.
Well, and on the, you know, I mean, all of the election concerns that we've watched happen since the pandemic, I mean, I've seen statistics that suggest that elderly people vote by mail in large percentage, and that, you know, older people tend to skew more conservatively. And so there's at least some argument to be made that, look, by fighting all of this with the mail-in voting and the sort of easier access to voting, you're also hindering your own people's ability to participate, which of course makes total sense to me, but that doesn't seem to be the, you know, the same concern everywhere else.
Yeah, and I mean, like, piggybacking off of the Dropbox thing, right? If the pool of people who are allowed to help facilitate an election are narrowed, who is that going to penalize? You know, we don't know this for sure, but like, looking at more rural parts of Wisconsin, they have part-time clerks, so they have much smaller, you know, many fewer people involved in it. If that number is winnowed down even more, it could make it more burdensome for a clerk in a small community to run an election. So that, I think that is maybe definitely a consequence of this, or a potential consequence, I should say. And there's, you know, of course, voters still have to ratify it next week or vote it down.
And so what are some of those are that's what we've got coming up immediately on the horizon. And I would just say, again, you're listening to A Public Affair. I'm the guest host, Jessa Nicholson-Gatz. We're talking to Jack Kelly, a journalist from Wisconsin Watch, who's been keeping close tabs on the constitutional tomfoolery that we have sort of going through our legislature in the upcoming election. And you can call and chat with us at 608-467-5627. You can tweet at us at WORTTALK or email us at talk@wartfm.org. We are WART89.9. So in addition to what people are going to be asked to cast votes on in the upcoming election, there's been talk of a number of other potential amendments that are going through these legislative sessions right now. Let's talk about some of those and what the where they are procedurally and what we should expect to see going into November and from there.
The amendments on the ballot next week are not the last amendments that voters will be asked to weigh in on this year. There are two more, to my knowledge, and if there are more, I apologize, but I believe it's just two more. There's actually going to be one on the August primary ballot, which is unusual. In my reporting, I had not countered another amendment placed on the August ballot. Not at least that doesn't jump out. They're almost always April or November. The one in August, again, going back to what we were talking about earlier, stems from a policy dispute between the governor and the legislature. This one, which was originally going to be on the ballot in November, lawmakers amended to put it on the ballot in August, would give the legislature, not the governor, say over how certain federal funds are spent by the state. So, you know, back up a couple of years, pandemic, major federal aid packages are being passed. The biggest one, I think the biggest one in terms of dollar amounts being the American Rescue Plan under President Joe Biden, when one of his signature kind of legislative accomplishment in his early days in August, sends millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars, billions of dollars to states across the country. Wisconsin received a sizable portion of that. And the governor, pretty much single-handedly got to dole out that money. And so we saw him use it on things like his, you know, Main Street Bounce Back program. He used it on all sorts of stuff. Republicans, they passed a bill saying that, wait a second.
We don't like it.
usually the power of the purse is left to the legislature. We should be the ones earmarking these federal dollars. And they passed legislation doing that. Of course, Evers was not going to give up his authority to earmark all of this money. And so he vetoed it. And so they have now passed a constitutional amendment that would do the same thing. It would give the legislature, not the governor, say over how certain federal funds are spent. So that'll be on the ballot in August. The one in November is also a little interesting, and lawmakers almost seem to be trying to get out ahead of this, largely reflective of things that have happened in other states. So this one would declare that only so-called qualified electors can vote in an election for national, state, or local offices, or at a statewide or local referendum.
And then are there other elections besides national, state, and local?
The key in that clause is qualified electors, because a qualified elector is defined as a U.S. citizen age 18 or older. And this largely seems to be a reaction to certain towns in different parts of the country that have allowed non-citizens to vote in certain local elections. There's a handful of them in Maryland. I think a couple of them in Vermont. I think it has spanned elsewhere that let non-citizens vote for their local races. And lawmakers seem to be trying to get out ahead of that here in Wisconsin, because that would be a policy proposal that probably would be popular in a place like Madison. So seems to try to get out in front of people on that one. So those two will also come up. There have also been a number of amendments introduced for first consideration. So yes. Basically preparing them, if Republicans maintain their majorities, to queue them up in the next legislative session starting in January of 2025 to put them on future ballots as referendum. So we can talk about those as well, but I'll stop there and let you jump in with any questions or anything else.
Well, I was going to ask you, do you know what the motivation was to sort of bump up the funding question to August? Do we have details on that, or is that just...
I'm sure they spoke to it when they were pursuing it. I don't remember offhand what the reasoning was.
And yeah, there are a number, because I know voter ID is one that they're talking about going through the first time. There are a few different things that are sort of on the deck, and obviously outcome of the election may change some of that. We don't know, but they're really, it seems like a lot all at once to me. I mean, it seems like a disproportionate number of proposed amendments to a constitution in one swoop.
I like to use this word often in my writing, a flurry of constitutional amendments is maybe an appropriate word for it. So there were many of these introduced. Democrats also, of course, are empowered to introduce constitutional amendments. They just don't have the votes to pass them. So these ones that I'm discussing have largely been introduced. They've been introduced by Republicans. And some of them, but not all of them, made it through this session. So like GOP lawmakers proposed requiring a two-thirds supermajority in both chambers of the legislature to increase taxes in Wisconsin. That one passed in the assembly, but it didn't get a Senate vote, so it did not advance. They've advanced an amendment that got backing in both chambers that would prevent the state or a local government from preventing people from gathering in places of worship during a state of emergency. So obviously this was something that popped up during COVID when local health officials were preventing people from going to church or whatever it might be. There's one that you had mentioned that would codify an existing law that basically that requires voters to show an ID before they cast their ballot. It's Wisconsin's so-called voter ID law. This one's interesting because it had passed the assembly last session and it didn't get a Senate vote, but this time around, it did get support in both chambers. So it'll be teed up next session for second consideration that could then be on the ballot. And this one's really interesting too, thinking about, what are the motivations you had said. Senator Van Wongard from southeastern Wisconsin, the Racine County area, who was is the lead author on this, said during testimony, "I don't know what the Wisconsin Supreme Court is going to say about voter ID, whether it violates the state constitution, but I'm not willing to take a chance. This is why we're doing this now. This is why we need action." And so there are several other proposals, and it is noteworthy. Obviously the big development in Wisconsin in the last 2 months, over the last kind of 3.5-4 months, there are new legislative districts in place in Wisconsin.
I was gonna introduce that topic here, the maps, and that was obviously so. Just for, and I one of the last times I subbed in here for a public affair, I know we talked some about the maps because the decision had just come down, and that was before the legislature took some action on that. So it doesn't look like the courts are going to be drawing the maps. But why don't we talk for a minute about that and what the concerns were and how that's all going to play out.
Yeah. So a group of Democratic aligned voters filed a lawsuit once Justice Janet Protasiewicz was sworn in to the state Supreme Court in August, giving them giving the liberal justices a 4-3 majority on the court for the first time in, I think, 15 years. And effectively, the lawsuit was challenging many, many things, but the court eventually ruled that because Wisconsin has legislative districts that included what they were referring to as municipal islands, little pieces of the district that were wholly divorced from the rest of the district, that did not meet the constitutional requirement of the districts being contiguous, contiguity, and they threw them out, ordering new districts to be drawn. And so the litigation unfolds, and as it becomes clearer and clearer that the court is not going to accept a proposal submitted by Republican lawmakers or a conservative aligned group, Republicans choose to adopt districts drawn by Governor Tony Evers. They pass them through the legislature. The governor signs them into law, meaning that for the first time in 15, or, you know, first time in 13, 14 years, the previous maps, which were drawn by Republicans, they were heavily gerrymandered to favor Republicans, are no longer in place. And Wisconsin will have competitive legislative races in 2024. And that is significant. And that underscores a lot of the work that Republicans are doing with these constitutional amendments. It's this idea that Republican hold on the legislature has not been so tenuous as it is now for 15 years. And I mean, to be clear, the new maps, they still favor Republicans.
Yes.
Much less so. There is a path for Democrats to win the majority, certainly in the state Senate, though that probably won't happen until, if it is going to happen, it probably would not happen until 2026 because of the way that the districts are staggered in terms of elections. Odd number Senate districts are on the ballot 1 year and then 2 years later, even number districts, so they're staggered from one another. And so it's noteworthy that as, they in some way, if you ask Democrats, they see this as Republicans racing against the clock to lock in their majority because their grip on the legislature might be slipping through their fingers. Republicans say, it doesn't matter what the maps look like. Republicans are going to win because we have better candidates and Wisconsinites have benefited from our policies over the last decade. And so it creates a whole different layer and another interesting dynamic to, when you're thinking about things like the amendments that are being advanced right now.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think to me, there's something that's just a little uncomfortable with like this fire sale of, because there was something similar in my view when Walker left office and Evers was coming in and there was this push to like greatly limit gubernatorial powers through basically every administrative technique that the legislature had available to them. And so it seems to me that it's sort of like, all right, well, if we can't win, then we're just going to make it very difficult for anyone else to accomplish anything. I don't think that's very good government, but that that has nothing to do with whose side I'm on here. To me, again, I think that if you live in a democracy, it should be about what the people are voting for. And you shouldn't take steps to suppress their vote. You shouldn't take steps to prevent the people's will from going into place. What can people do if they share my view?
That's a complicated question. People...
other than vote, which hopefully everyone listening is doing,
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I can really speak to what they can do, but certainly that Wisconsin has, I have noticed this, has an electorate that is very engaged and very plugged in and very conscious of some of these kind of procedural minutiae that voters in other states might not often be thinking about. And so it is really fascinating to see the level of engagement on all the whole spread of the political spectrum in Wisconsin, and to see how voters either working with outside groups or just among themselves organize themselves to work on things. That is definitely, we see that everywhere, but it happens very often in Wisconsin. And I think that is a really interesting and unique dynamic about our state government system.
No, absolutely. Just a reminder, folks, you're listening to a public affair here on 89.9 WART. You can call in and chat about constitutional amendments or whatever else is on your mind at 608-467-5627. Or you can tweet at us at WORTTALK, WART Talk, or email us at talk@wortfm.org. Again, this is Jessa Nicholson Getz speaking with journalist Jack Kelly. And I agree with you. I mean, it, you know, just is, I don't know, it's a frustrating thing to watch, to feel as a politically engaged citizen that you're trying to have your voice heard and people are disinterested in allowing that to function naturally. And of course, the rejoinder to that is, well, what's more natural than amending the Constitution? You know, I mean, isn't that exactly what we're supposed to do? If the laws aren't working for us, shouldn't we have the ability to go in and alter them? And the answer is yes. I just wish it were more about elevating people's rights and protections and freedoms and less about suppressing policy that people are opposed to. Because, of course, I'm such a constitutional idealist that I think it should be, you know, documents should be breathing documents that maximize our protections to live freely and enjoy a lack of government intrusion, but also, you know, the ability to function in a democracy. And yeah, I don't know.
I think it is worth noting as well that politically, you know, political maneuvering and the pursuit to preserve power is a bipartisan effort.
Absolutely.
We, you know, gerrymandering, especially when it's discussed in Wisconsin, is often portrayed as, you know, the Republican effort to, you know, manufacture power for themselves when they might not otherwise have it. Obviously, we have seen Democrats gerrymander states severely in other parts of the country, Maryland, I mean, New York, obviously New York, they've had a big piece of litigation. There was a version, I believe, of the Illinois congressional map that got floated around that had every seat in the Illinois, or like in the U.S. House from the state of Illinois, touching the city of Chicago somehow. If you look at the geography of the state of Illinois, that is very far from Chicago if it stretches from Chicago to the bottom of Illinois. And so, you know, it is interesting. I think we see this playing out to some degree anyways, is that oftentimes political actors will pursue power when the opportunity is there to do it. I mean, we see this in a way when, you know, there are Democrats for the first time since they were in the majority back in, I think, 2009-10 or 2008-9 in the assembly. We see tons of Democratic members of the assembly. They're leaving. They're running for other offices. They're trying to, you know, they're running for open seats in the state Senate. And it's notable because, you know, when you think about what comes with these other offices, it often comes with greater resources, greater influence, greater staff, et cetera, et cetera. So it is an interesting thing. What one other constitutional amendment that lawmakers passed this session that's probably worth talking about as well, just because of the political environment that we are in, is kind of like an escalation of the Republican targeting of DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts. They actually approved an amendment this session, which tees them up to potentially do it again next session if they remain in the majority. That would prevent, you know, a governmental entity from, it's a governmental entity may not discriminate or grant preferential treatment on the basis of race, sex, color, ethnicity, or national origin in public employment, public education, public contracting, or public administration. Like, this stems very directly from a growing movement across the country and in Wisconsin with Republican lawmakers targeting DEI efforts. Obviously, we saw that play out in a dispute between Assembly Speaker Robin Voss and the UW system, where he was keeping certain raises, he was preventing certain raises for state employees being, or university employees being enacted. He wasn't letting dollars for things like a UW-Madison engineering building, a new building, be released. So the constitutional amendment process is fascinating, and it has definitely kind of trickled into many other places where you might not have expected it 10, 20 years ago.
Well, and that's actually, oh, look, and I am just seeing that it looks like we're using an alternative number to call today because we've got we've got no receptionist, but our producer is saying that you can call our regular number, which Jade, I believe, is 256-2001, but you'll need to press 9. And we think somebody's trying to call us. So if you are trying to call, go ahead and you can dial 256-2001 and you'll just have to hit extension 9. So I just want anyone that was trying to reach us, because we've got that alternative number today going through, you're welcome to try either way. And sorry, I now I've lost track of myself, but we were talking about the, you know, that your last point is just the connection between state-funded universities. I don't, you know, like what happens in that setting. There are so many institutions that are affected by the way that states do things that people don't necessarily connect. And then, you know, I mean, of course, again, just from my career perspective, I do Title IX litigation all the time in the context of UW. And so there you've got a federal protection about, among other things, like the, you know, the one you're just talking about, you can't discriminate on the basis of sex, race, et cetera, et cetera. You've got Title IX protections that there's some federal law that interprets that differently. You know, I mean, what that means is different in a Title IX context than I think it probably is intended to be, at least in this context. And there are going to be clashes there, and that'll have to work through the system, because, of course, if we have a conflict between a state constitutional provision and a federal constitutional provision, then that becomes a federal litigation issue as well, at least it potentially can. And so I think that people, and I agree with you, I mean, my example with Marcy's Law and the victim witness units and DA's offices, I don't think your average voter was aware that somebody was, you know, like, just boots on the ground reality, somebody's going to have to pick up the phone and call all of these victims to notify them every time. And who's going to do that? If that person doesn't exist, that's kind of a full-time job in a county like Dane or Milwaukee or Waukesha, where you've got six figures population and you've got multiple branches. And, you know, I mean, even in a little one judge county, one DA county, you're still going to have a substantial burden there to make sure we do it. And it looks like we do have Lou on the line with a question. It looks like they want to talk about what counter movements exist to these referendums. Lou, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Tell us about what you're thinking about.
I'm really enjoying this. Mr. Kelly's very informative. I just wanted to know why it is that there's been such a weak counter mobilization against these two amendments, given that they're clearly Republican-sponsored amendments, and the League of Women Voters, the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, which disclosure I'm a member of both, have come out against the amendments and have let people know. But it seems like the Democratic Party of Wisconsin is laid very low. I wonder if Mr. Kelly knows why that is.
Yeah, well, thanks for the question, Lou, and good to hear from you. It is interesting. I think, you know, when you think back to why schedule these amendments to be on the April ballot, many Republican lawmakers were expecting there to be an ongoing dogfight for the Republican presidential nomination. You're expecting a lot of Republicans to turn out for a very competitive race. And Democrats just lack that right going into the April election. You know, there's some of this movement to vote uninstructed and to protest President Biden's handling of the war in Gaza, but there is not kind of a standard bearer, so to speak, on the ballot in April for Democrats in a way like it was last spring, when you had Justice Prosewitz running statewide with huge financial backing for the Democratic Party and a ton of voter interest. Some of the good government groups have, you know, come out against the amendments, but you are not wrong in your assessment that these are flying under the radar and that the messaging has been limited to niche audiences on both sides of the political spectrum and has not really tapped into the broader political consciousness of Wisconsinites, like we've seen other amendments in the past.
And we touched on this a little bit, Jack, but part of that could be the way that the language is written, because this is one, like, And when I'm using the word wonky, I mean in the policy wonk way, that very traditional, you know, like that it doesn't, I think, when you read the questions as they're presented, it doesn't clue your average citizen into what the ramifications might be. I think it's like, hey, should we have things be fair? And everyone's like, well, yeah, things should be fair. I'm going to check yes. And
yeah, the language of the question is also, it's always a factor. I mean, it's worth noting that lawmakers are the ones that get to write the question. Yeah. So if you are the majority party trying to advance an amendment, you are obviously writing it in a way that, you know, you'll hope will garner support from voters. So that's an element too of it. Also, like, it's complicated. They're, let's be honest, niche questions about these kinds of obscure things that happened, you know, I would think many people would say, hopefully in this once in a lifetime moment of the pandemic. And so I think it's just been hard to really rev people up around them a little bit on both sides. And I think that, you know, and to some degree, the vote yes people just kind of maintain this inherent advantage that most amendments get ratified and they get to write the question. So that is certainly true. But yeah, I mean, it's complicated. I mean, the forthcoming story that my colleague Alexander Schur and I have worked on, and he's done some amazing reporting for it, kind of bears this out. But when you go out and talk to people who are experts in election administration, the clerks that run elections in Wisconsin, we have this very unique system where there are, you know, 1,850 municipal clerks, 72 county clerks. They administer elections. We don't do it at the county level, the state level. The experts, the people that do this, the people that live and breathe this, don't exactly know how it's going to bear out and what exactly it's going to look like if it's enacted. And that, I think that is really noteworthy. So if voters are confused, I think that is understandable, given that the people who carry out elections are confused about what exactly the implications of the amendment would be.
And we've got just a couple minutes left here. And so I want to, Jack, again, this is, you've been listening to A Public Affair on 89.9 WART. We're here with Jack Kelly, journalist at Wisconsin Watch. As we sort of conclude, we've got, like I said, a couple minutes left. What should people be, if they take one or two things away from this conversation today, what should they be thinking about?
Oh, gosh. I think that it's important to do your homework about the candidates and the issues that are on your ballot. You, of course, should support your local news organization, whether it's Wisconsin Watch or WORT or many of the other great news organizations that are working in Wisconsin. You know, if you don't know where your polling place is, if you don't know if you're registered to vote, you find all that information online at myvote.wi.gov. I recommend taking a few minutes to think about what's on your ballot, doing a little background research on it, and then, of course, getting out there and being engaged. I think that elections that have a lot of voters are always the elections that are the most interesting to cover. And so from that perspective as a journalist, I'd leave it at that.
There you go. Well, Jack, thank you so much for your time and for kind of breaking down this process that I think a lot of people feel isn't the most legible, just sitting in your average seat. And this has been A Public Affair. I'm your guest host, Jessa Nicholson Getz. As I said, we've been with Jack Kelly talking about constitutional amendments. So this is WART FM 89.9. Thank you so much for listening. And I'm not sure exactly what's coming up next today, but I'm sure it's good. Yeah.
You are listening to WORT 89.9 FM Madison.
This is Pacifica Radio's Letters on Politics. On today's show,
it was anti-corruption, anti-imperialist, anti-interventionist group. And those were very clearly what they were calling for from the beginning. And it's what made so many people in Yemen join their cause.
A conversation on the history of Yemen, and specifically the Houthis, a group that the Biden administration has just reclassified as a terrorist organization.
Many in the Arab world understand this to be a legitimate response to genocide. So the Houthis are saying that they are enacting their duties under the Genocide Convention, Article 1, Prevention of Genocide, the state's duties to prevent genocide. And many people are seeing this as a righteous form of resistance to what's happening in Palestine.
Our guest is Yemeni American scholar Shireen Al-Adimi, a non-resident fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. That's next on Letters and Politics. But first, the news.
Hello, this is Julie Candler with the BBC News. Officials in the United States and Israel say Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu wants to reschedule talks on operations in Rafah a day after he cancelled them. They were to discuss U.S. alternatives to a potentially catastrophic Israeli offensive on the packed city in southern Gaza. Hugo Bashega has more details.
Prime Minister Netanyahu cancelled the visit of a senior Israeli delegation to Washington in an angry reaction to the U.S. abstention at the UN Security Council on Monday. The vote approved for the first time a resolution calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. The White House had said the Israeli decision was an overreaction. There's growing frustration in the Biden administration with the way Israel is conducting the war amid a worsening humanitarian crisis in Gaza. The meeting had been arranged to discuss alternatives to a potentially catastrophic Israeli ground offensive on the city of Rafah, where more than 1 million Palestinians are sheltering.
Investigators in the United States have recovered the data recorder from the ship that crashed into the Baltimore Bridge on Tuesday, leading it to collapse. They're hoping it will help explain why the container vessel lost power soon after leaving Baltimore port. Prosecutors in Spain say they want the former head of the country's football federation jailed for 2.5 years for kissing a player on the mouth following the National Women's Team World Cup victory. Luis Rubiales is facing charges of sexual assault and coercion. He denies wrongdoing. Here's Danny Eberhard.
It was a scandal that overshadowed a sporting triumph.